House Committee on Revenue for February 25th, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues and to our audience, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2171. And I want to note that the point of opening this bill and posting it for today was actually to consider the Dash 2 amendments having to do with possible increase in the beer tax. As it turns out, we are not ready to go ahead with that hearing today. I promise that if we deal with this bill 2171 to consider a shift to AGI, which is what the original bill is on, or for any other purpose, we will hold another public hearing. But for today, we're not taking any testimony on that public hearing. And I apologize to anyone who signed up to testify on that bill today. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2171. It turns out that I have to testify on another committee on another bill. I'm going to stand the committee at ease for a few minutes, and I've already asked Vice Chair Vega Peterson to reconvene the committee and open a hearing on House Bill 2555 if I'm not back by the time we have a significant number of committee members here. So with that, the committee will stand at ease.
Great. I am going to call the House Revenue Committee back to order. Welcome back. We always already had a notice that we will not be hearing House Bill 2171 today. So I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2555. Kyle, would you mind telling us a little bit about that bill?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2555 is relating to cigarette taxation. And what it would do is it would increase the cigarette tax under ORS 323.031 from 30 mils to 80 mils. And I'll get into a little bit more detail in just a second on what that means. The tax increase will become effective January 1st, 2016. And in addition to that, there's also the application of a floor tax that will be applicable January 1st, 2016 as well, based on the inventory at both the distributor and retail level for any stamps or cigarettes that are in inventory at that time. And the floor tax is on that increment amount, so the increase in the tax to account for the change in the tax that would become effective.
Okay.
So there's a couple things, just to give a little bit of background, I have a few things up on OLIS. The first under meeting materials is just the section of the basic facts document that LRO puts out, and we discussed this a little bit at the beginning of the session. There's a few pages related to excise taxes, so there's some historical information that's up there that I thought I would just put up there for the committee if they want to look at historical receipts or anything of that nature. But the one committee or the meeting material that I wanted to actually walk through really quickly is under House Bill 2555, Media Materials, and it should be, I believe it's near the top of the list. It's titled Cigarette Tax Distribution, mm-hmm. HB 2555. And so what this handout essentially does is it's showing the distribution of cigarette taxation, and there's really three statutes that affect the taxation. So The bill we have in front of us, House Bill 2555, only relates to, if we're looking at the chart on the far right, the ORS 323.031. So the current law right now has 30 mils, which equates to 60 cents per pack of cigarettes, assuming we're talking 20 cigarettes per pack, which is the most common amount of cigarettes in a pack. So if we scroll down to the second page, I have the distribution, what the distribution would be under House Bill 2555 with the changes that are in the bill. So it would make the change to ORS 323.031, and this is on the second page of the handout, and I've discreetly circled it in red. But so you can see that the change there goes to 80 mils and $1.60 per pack, and the tax as of 1/1/2016 with this change would then be $2.32 per pack rather than $1.32. One thing with the bill is the distribution of where these receipts are under ORS 323.031 are left blank. So initially, if you scroll up, you can see where the distribution is right now. We're here with the tax increase. That would have to would be something that have to be specified. So that gives an idea of the distribution. And then I did have one last note I wanted to make in regards to the floor tax. So we discussed on the 11th of February, House Bill 2489. And that bill comes to us from the Department of Revenue. And what we have right now is we have 2 1-cent increases per pack scheduled under current law to begin. The first would be 1-1-2016, and the second 1-1-2018. And as it was only a penny, there was the way the law was written, a floor tax was not included in those increases, and rather there was an expiration of the cigarette tax stamps. And without going into what House Bill 2489 does, but that would just cause a little bit of, could cause issue for retailers, distributors, and the Department of Revenue in administering it. And I just wanted to call attention to the floor tax change that's in House Bill 2555. Reflects the tax change in the bill, but it misses that 1 cent increase that is under current law. So whether or not that needs to be in there or not, it's just something I wanted to bring to the attention of the committee so they're aware of it, that there the tax change on that day would actually be there'd be 1 penny more that wouldn't be applicable into the floor tax as is written in 2555.
Okay. Thank you, Kyle. So it looks like the first person we have up to testify is Justin Freeman. Welcome, and go ahead and introduce yourself when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Freeman. I'm Legislative Director to State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. Unfortunately, Representative Greenlick could not attend this hearing today, so he asked me to share some remarks on his behalf. Rep. Greenlick's motivation for this bill was very simple. Studies have shown that cigarettes are more addictive than heroin, and adolescents are particularly vulnerable. Studies have also shown that price changes are more impactful for adolescents than they are for adults. So a price change for a dollar example for a pack of cigarettes would go a long way to reducing the overall use of cigarettes and reduce the number of Oregonians lost to tobacco-related diseases. The current version of HB 2555 has a $1 a pack increase. But Rep. Greenlick would be happy with any amount above that. Thanks for your time. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this panelist? Okay. Thank you. All right. Next, we have Matt Evans, Taxpayer Association of Oregon.
Thank you, Vice Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I hail from Raleigh Hills, Oregon, and I'm here today representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. Just want to make three quick points, if I might. First of all, I think it's fair to say that the state of Oregon has not proven itself to be a very good steward of tobacco tax revenues. I mean, we saw in the previous slide, only 1/5 of the money raised from the tobacco tax actually goes to tobacco cessation programs, which is really the point. The rest of it is used as backfill for various kinds of spending, including under the Oregon Health Plan, which was originally sold to this body as a program that would compete with other general fund programs and would never have a dedicated source of revenue, which turned out not to be the case. The voters have gone to the ballot box and have chosen to vote against tobacco taxes most recently. That should be taken into consideration. We also have to look, I think, at unintended consequences, in particular the creation of a black market in tobacco products, which has caused problems in some other states and probably ought to be taken into consideration. We essentially make lawbreakers out of people who otherwise would be law-abiding citizens. And then finally, of course, is the regressive nature of all sales taxes, including tobacco taxes, where they hit our most vulnerable citizens economically the hardest. And in spite of the fact that we do want to try to prevent those folks from smoking as much as they do or perhaps quitting entirely, the fact of the matter is that we're taxing, as the previous panelist said, one of the most addictive products possible and punishing folks who simply can't get away from it through no fault of their own. I'd be happy to take any questions the committee members might have.
Questions?
Thank you
very much. Next, we have Sarah Higginbogen.
Thank you, Vice Chair Vega Peterson and committee members. My name is Sarah Higginbotham. I'm the Government Relations Director for Oregon for the American Heart Association. I'm also here today on behalf of not only the American Heart Association, but the American Lung Association. I'll try and keep this brief, but I wanted to just highlight a few key things about tobacco taxes and tobacco tax increases. Let me just preface by saying, for those of you that don't know, and for those of you, I think it merits saying again as a reminder, tobacco use remains the number one preventable cause of death in Oregon, and we spend $1.54 million on the health effects of this. Another thought to consider, and I know this is one of the motivations for the bill's sponsor, Representative Greenlich, is that as of today, 213,400 Oregon youth will start using tobacco and become smokers. And as of today, 68,000 Oregon kids who are alive today will die from tobacco use. Additionally, glaring health disparities exist in low-income Oregonians, as you just heard, are adversely and disproportionately affected by tobacco use. We would argue that they stand to reap the biggest benefits from an increase in tobacco tax, which shows that it reduces use, and they also stand to benefit the most from investing that money in prevention and cessation programs. It's been 50 years since the U.S. Surgeon General issued its first report. Just 50 years. And here's the great news. We have a lot of difficult decisions to make about Oregon policies, trying to figure out what's the most effective and what works. When it comes to tobacco policy, let me be really clear. We already know what policies work. Tobacco taxes achieve a win-win solution for states, including for Oregon, especially as they face severe fiscal crises and work to balance budgets while preserving essential public services. So to summarize the Heart Association and the Lung Association's position on tobacco tax increases, significant increases, we support and advocate for significant increases in tobacco excise taxes at the state, county, if we could, at the county and municipal levels. Here in Oregon, we can't do that. Allocation of at least some of these revenues that are generated toward tobacco control, prevention, and cessation programs, as well as other health-related initiatives. I'll quickly highlight just about four more points for you all. In January of 2015, so just last month, the American Lung Association released its State of Tobacco Control Report. Oregon received an F in terms of our level, where our tax is right now, which is $1.31. We're falling behind other states like Washington to our north, which is $3.25, Montana, which is $1.70, and Arizona, which is $2. So currently we're 28th in the nation. On top of that, we actually ranked really well on the other, what we call the third leg. There are three legs to this stool when it comes to tobacco control, and we ranked very well when it came to indoor clean air laws, so I applaud Oregon for that. But the third leg of this stool, which I haven't yet mentioned, is investment in tobacco prevention and cessation. Again, Oregon gets a failing grade, funding just 28% of recommended CDC level. Tobacco tax increases allow us to start to address both of those key components to tobacco control. The evidence, I'll say one note on the health wins, the budget win, and then just investment of these dollars. So on the health win, there's overwhelming evidence supporting the health benefits. Higher tobacco taxes induce quitting, prevent relapse, and reduce consumption, and prevent starting. The general consensus is that for every 10% increase in the real price of cigarettes, the increased cost reduces overall cigarette consumption by approximately 3 to 5% for adults, 3 to 5% for young adult smokers, and cuts the number of kids who smoke by about 6 to 7%. We know that small increases are ineffective because they can be absorbed by price discounts, such as coupons and other efforts by the tobacco industry, and are not noticed by the smoker. And that additional reductions in overall smoking are really seen when we combine the tax increase with investment in tobacco control efforts. One note on the budget win for this state, higher tobacco taxes save money by reducing tobacco-related health care costs, including Medicaid expenses. States can realize even greater health benefits and cost savings, again, by allocating some of that revenue to tobacco and cessation programs. National and state polling have found overwhelming public support for tobacco tax increases, and polls show that when it comes to balancing budgets, voters prefer raising tobacco taxes to other tax increases or cutting crucial programs such as education or public safety. One final note, you've heard me mention multiple times about investment in tobacco cessation and tobacco control work. I just want to take a moment and applaud the program that hopefully all of you know about, which is TPEP, Tobacco Organs Evidence-Based Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. Since it started in its creation in 1996, it has cut cigarette consumption in half. Currently, it's funded again at about 28% of the recommended CDC level, but when it's funded, the work that it produces is really exceptional and profound. So in summary, the American Heart Association and American Lung Association are happy to support this bill. We are eager to have conversations with all of you about the right path forward towards a tobacco tax increase, including something higher than what this bill presents, and how we might use revenue to not only support the TPEP program, but other health-related programs and expenses. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative,
I was wondering if you could discuss where the American Heart and Lung Associations were on the recent ballot measure to legalize marijuana, which is also smoked.
It is, and actually the American Heart Association did not take a position on the ballot measure, and I'd be happy to follow up with any. To my knowledge, there are American Heart Association is a very large organization that does a lot of research and scientific peer-reviewed journals, and to my knowledge, there are a number of scholarly articles that our researchers have done around marijuana use, but to date, we do not have not, to my knowledge, taken policy positions on marijuana use, and that's in large part because I think Oregon's really out in front of the rest of the country, so these are conversations we're having right now.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Has the association taken a position on electronic cigarettes?
Yeah, the American Heart Association has taken a strong position on electronic cigarettes. We support, let me just start by saying that we recognize they present a great threat to addicting a new generation of nicotine addicts. We support them being regulated and treated like tobacco products. And the two main areas that we're most concerned about is in, making sure that minors can't purchase them, which if you don't know, Oregon kids can walk into a store right now and purchase e-cigarettes, and inclusion in the Indoor Clean Air Act.
Follow up. Thank you. And the is it taking a position on whether someone who's already smoking that decides to shift over, is that a good thing, bad thing, or no thing?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. And literally in a conference at D.C., the National Tobacco Control Conference, where the Surgeon General was, we looked at all and got a pretty in-depth review of the studies that have been done. And what we know is that there are three major scientific studies that have been done on the cessation effectiveness of e-cigarettes. One said might help, one said didn't help, and one was inconclusive, kind of neutral. So the American Heart Association, again, as a science-based organization, says our position is that we don't know enough yet to know whether they can reduce harm or cause harm, and so we just don't know enough yet on that front. And then what we are saying to physicians is we are reminding everyone and encouraging physicians or counselors to know that there is no FDA-approved cessation device that's an electronic cigarette, and that we would encourage them to use FDA-approved cessation devices before encouraging the use of an e-cigarette. So I think there's more research to be done.
Follow up. So the question, I guess, is we raise the tax on cigarettes. People start shifting over to electronic cigarettes. Have you achieved the outcome that you desired by causing people to smoke less?
That's a great question. Let's see if I can answer it this way. And right now I'm speaking for the American Heart Association. The American Lung Association has a slightly different position. What I can share with you is the American Heart Association's current position on taxation of e-cigarettes as it relates to conventional combustible cigarettes. And right now, the Heart Association is recommending a small differential between if, for example, if we're to start taxing e-cigarettes, we would want to keep a small differential and keep combustible cigarettes slightly higher. And that's because we do believe there could be reduced harm from e-cigarettes, and we want that represented in the taxation policy. What I will say is this is still being discussed by my colleagues. I know that I don't want to speak for them, but some national organizations support an equal tax, and the American Heart Association happens to support a differential.
Follow up. Thank you. So the challenge for those of us on the revenue committee is what happens if we raise this tax on cigarettes, everybody flocks over to e-cigarettes. No particular good has been done. In fact, what you just said was the association is only willing to admit a very modest benefit in the e-cigarette side of the equation. So what have we really done other than take revenue away from the state?
Just to ask you a question, Representative.
I'm sorry. So we don't tax e-cigarettes. We do tax other cigarettes.
Oh, I would encourage this committee to tax e-cigarettes, and I would encourage them to raise the tax on conventional cigarettes and tobacco. And then I would encourage them to pass a tax or create a tax for e-cigarettes.
Here, let me explain what I'm concerned about.
Okay.
I had some meetings with some e-cigarette folks the other day, and they explained to me that if we began to tax them, mm-hmm. People would just flock to these online sources where you can buy this stuff by the container load. And what ends up happening then is the current revenue that we enjoy from, if that's the right word, our current tax policy, however it's defined, would be lost, and no particular good will be done. Because people will have gone to e-cigarettes, and if we tax those, they will flock to these online sources. That's how it was explained to me. Now what I need to know is I was listening to folks that were they sell e-cigarettes, so they're not wildly enthusiastic about having them taxed. So perhaps you can share with us your take on what they were saying. Was it correct? Are there these online sources of this stuff?
There are online sources, which I think is certainly a related problem that you're bringing up to this bigger issue, and also certainly there are inherent it's also a problem that probably has to be dealt with in other venues as well. I'm not an expert on how to regulate the online market or the overseas market. What I will say is we will see substantial and profound health impacts by raising the tax on conventional cigarettes and tobacco and on e-cigarettes. And even I say this not having considered fully the issue that you're bringing up, that I think the benefits that we would get from moving forward with increases on conventional and e-cigarettes would both increase revenue. And I'm not prepared to say on the record that it would outweigh the loss that we would see to an overseas market, but I certainly can speak to the profound health impacts, and I think that we would see substantial health impacts and benefits from raising it. That's a great question. I'd be happy to follow up with you.
Madam Chair. Thank you, and I very much hope you do. That would be helpful. And Madam Chair, I have one last question. So Washington obviously has a much higher tax mm-hmm. than we do. And so under the numbers you've been giving us, we should anticipate that Washington has had a dramatic drop mm-hmm. in the number of young people smoking as a result of their much higher tax. But I've been led to believe that many Washingtonians are sneaking into Oregon and buying their cigarettes. And so I'm just curious what the numbers are showing in Washington about the decline in all the problems that go with smoking. Do you have those numbers in Washington so we can kind of check to see how their increase is working for them?
Vice Chair Vega Peterson and Representative Benz, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I would be happy to get them, and I'm sure we can, both from the state agencies there and advocates there. And then the second thing I'll just add is you mentioned two things, Representative. One was youth access and smoking and whether the higher cost was actually making a difference. So I'd be happy to get those numbers. And then the issue of car trunking, but throwing it in your trunk, going to Oregon, bringing it back. I would say that a high schooler in many parts of the state that probably can't drive or doesn't have access to a car. I think we have two different issues there, and I would think that the teenager in Spokane or the 13-year-old in Olympia is less likely to be able to head down to Oregon just to scam a Plaid pantry to sell them cigarettes. But those two issues brought up are very important issues, and be happy to follow up on each of them individually.
Just a comment. I think the folks in Spokane are probably going to go to Idaho. Just guessing.
Idaho has a higher tax than we do, so I don't know that they would actually reap any benefits. But yes, perhaps, Representative.
I'm not sure that that's true, but yeah.
Oh, Idaho. Sorry. Forgive me. Utah and Montana. I got them mixed up.
There we go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Representative Benz, I can tell you where they're going. They're going to Hood River for both cigarettes and cheaper hard liquor. Yes, we beat them on both counts. Sarah, a question, though, following up on Representative Bence's line of questioning, I would think then nationally, it would be great if you had these numbers, but I think New York has the highest tax per pack. Is that correct?
Yeah, the city of Chicago. Yeah.
So theoretically, then, if there is a real direct connect between price and usage or whatever, that those states that have the highest taxes should have fewer tobacco users, and those states that have fewer taxes should have more. Is that Could you bring some statistics? I'd love to see what
I'd be happy to. That's what studies show. Absolutely. Okay. And the city of Chicago, it actually, it's real fun if you ever get the chance to go there to stand in a store and watch someone pay $14 for a pack of cigarettes.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson.
I was wondering if you have statistics on the income level of smokers in the state of Oregon. It's my understanding that poor people are more likely to smoke. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Representative Whitsett and Vice Chair Rip Vega Peterson, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And there are a lot of great questions here, so I would also just offer to Chair Barnhart, who's here, and I keep addressing the Vice Chair, sorry, to Chair Barnhart and all the committee members, I would be happy to either provide a presentation, just send it to you electronically and get a lot of these questions answered. But yes, we have great data around that.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, next panel will be, Justin Rainey and Chris Gerard. Welcome, gentlemen.
Do you want to go first?
Do you want to go too?
Sure.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Vega Peterson, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bence, committee members. I'm Chris Gerard, CEO of Plaid Pantry, and I'm also chair of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association. Madam Vice Chair, Plaid and other retailers and our suppliers and vendors have something significant in common with the state of Oregon. We are all overly dependent on tobacco revenues, and we're steadily and inevitably going out of the cigarette business. The challenge is to find alternative sources of income before this happens. This proposed bill is not conducive to a smooth and orderly transition for businesses or for the state. A new dollar per pack tax would result in a net loss of about $20 million to Oregon's overall economy. This is because there would be 50 million fewer taxable packs sold in the 15-16 fiscal year if this bill is enacted. Additional state revenue will be much lower than expected, and it will be more than offset by lost sales, jobs, employment benefits, and in the legitimate law-abiding tax-paying businesses. The significant loss in taxable sales is due to decreased Washington cross-border shopping, increased Oregon tobacco users smuggling, and the general underlying decline in smoking. This effect becomes more pronounced the higher the tax. Businesses will not only lose the sales from the 50 million packs that disappear into the black market, but tobacco users buy other things in our stores. And it's even more important that we'll lose the non-tobacco sales that the former customers bought during their trip. This business will move to the underground economy and benefit those who engage in illegal smuggling activities. Excess tax increases now will produce less total revenue for the state in the long run. Much like withdrawing too much too early from a retirement account, the lower base of taxable packs will result in less revenue in the future for a shorter period of time as the use of these products continued to diminish. The legislature recently raised cigarette taxes very significantly, an 11% increase. It was just effective last year. And as was pointed out by staff, additional smaller increases in 16 and 18. We ask that you allow these increases to be absorbed by the system, review their impact before imposing yet higher taxes on top of these increases. We've submitted written testimony. I hope you'll have time to review it. It contains a detailed analysis of these big numbers. It's a big change if this goes through, and some useful exhibits that may get to some of the questions that you were asking earlier. Thank you for hearing my testimony. Please don't move this bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Justin Rainey. I'm here today on behalf of Reynolds America. Reynolds America is the second largest manufacturer of cigarettes in the United States. It's the parent company to American Snuff Company, Santa Fe Natural Tobacco Company, and RJR Vapor Company. Reynolds is here today in opposition to House Bill 2555. Legislation would increase the tax on cigarettes by $1 a pack. As it was brought up, the Oregon legislature recently increased the cigarette tax by 13 cents with the passage of the legislation, the grand bargain, and then it's set to increase by a penny over the next two bienniums, taking the Oregon cigarette tax up to $1.33 by 2019. Tobacco products are already heavily taxed at both the federal and the state level. In Oregon right now, the total tax on a pack of cigarettes is $2.32 when you add in the federal tax, which is $1.01. Tobacco taxes target a minority of the population and disproportionately impact those Oregonians with low incomes. Big tobacco companies do not pay the taxes. It's the low-income Oregonians that are asked to foot this bill. A much higher percentage of lower-income citizens smoke than those with high incomes. According to data that we have, 57.5% of smokers make less than $25,000 a year, or their households make less than $25,000 a year. 31% of those smokers had household incomes of less than $15,000 a year. Only 11% of smokers had household incomes that are greater than $50,000. So this tax really does target some of the lowest income Oregonians. It's a very selective and very regressive tax. Tobacco customers are just like everyone else, except they use tobacco. We don't feel that's a justification to single them out as a small group of citizens. Of the population, approximately 17% of Oregon's adult population uses tobacco, and they're asked to pay what generates roughly $250 million a year in taxes. You know, this is one of those where you compare it to some of the budgets. For example, that's enough to fund the entire Department of Fish and Wildlife budget, along with funds that are allocated to OHSU. The tax generates nearly six times as much as the Oregon insurance tax revenue, and it generates nearly three times more than Oregon estate tax revenues. What we've heard is and learned is higher tobacco taxes do not significantly reduce compensation or consumption, but it drives consumers to evade or avoid taxes. Oregon relies on tobacco revenue to meet many of its budget needs. It's a revenue stream that's already declining as consumption is decreasing somewhat. We feel a larger fact is tax avoidance and tax evasion. Tax increases drive a very significant amount of the formerly collectible taxes underground to the black market, including Native American outlets, organized crime operations, the internet, as well as roll your own cigarettes using the lower tax bulk tobacco. Oregon's neighboring states, with the exception of Washington, are all taxed much lower than Oregon. Higher taxes will force Oregonians to find cheaper ways to purchase cigarettes from other sources. For example, the tax in Idaho is 57 cents. The tax in Nevada is 80 cents. And in California, the tax is 87 cents. Mm-hmm. In Washington, the tax is just above $3. What we've seen from Washington is that higher cigarette taxes they do give reason for people to migrate across state lines to purchase their product. That would jeopardize Oregon's budget. Approximately 4.7 million cartons of cigarettes are annually purchased by Washington residents here in Oregon. That's equivalent roughly to a quarter of all of Oregon's taxable cigarette sales, so a pretty significant amount. That represents $55 million in tax revenue that's paid for by non-Oregon residents. Raising Oregon's tax rate by a dollar would potentially jeopardize this tax revenue stream. So for those reasons, we're here today in opposition to House Bill 2555, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions of this panel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do your stores sell the electronic cigarettes also then?
Madam Vice Chair, Vice Chair Bentz, yes, sir, we do. We don't get into it quite like the shops do, but we do carry some.
Follow-up. Are those sales increasing? We had someone appear before us a year ago or so that studies this and predicted. I believe she advises companies that she works for Wells Fargo, I think, was in their investment shop back in New York and advised us that in about 5 years we would see e-cigarettes take off like a rocket, sales like this, and regular cigarettes plummet as the technology for the e-cigarette device improved and made the experience of using one more like real smoking. I'm just curious if that is playing out in your sales of e-cigarettes.
Madam Vice Chair, Vice Chair Bentz, it was almost non-existent up until about a year ago, and it took off. It surprised everybody, but it kind of leveled off in our in our format. At about 3% equivalent of the tobacco category. Of course, a store that just sells the vaping products, it's 100% of their business. So, but it's we expected it to continue to climb, and there is some new technology coming out, but there's also some questions being raised about the product. So we're kind of taking a wait and see. We're not dedicating a lot of resources to that. We're just kind of following the trend rather than leading it.
Yeah, another question. So you had mentioned that your stores were in the process of transitioning to something else to draw people through the door than nicotine products. How's that transition working?
Well, it's Representative Bentz, sorry, Madam Chair. It's tough. The whole industry is struggling with it. Some people are trying to move into prepared foods. Of course, we have gasoline. But it's a big category. And the harder we try to get out of it, the more other people are getting out of it. The supermarkets don't care about it as much. And they tend to come to our format stores. So it's still a big part of our business. But we've got a bunch of other product categories, immediate consumable foods, drinks, beverages, and things. But it's in my testimony, you see charts of where the cigarettes have gone. It's half of what it was when I got here 20 years ago. Some of that smuggling, but a lot of it's people were getting the intended consequence of what we're trying to do. We don't want kids to smoke, and we know that it's not necessarily a healthy practice to use the products.
Thank you, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The gentleman from R.J. Reynolds. So I was very surprised to hear you say that increases in taxes on cigarettes do not lead to declining rates of tobacco usage, because everything I have ever read about them says just the opposite, and indeed our prior testifier from the Heart Association also said that, both from, you know, as economic policy, you know, tobacco is understood to be extremely price sensitive. And so I wonder where you're getting those statistics from.
Sure. Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner. You know, when you look at the population in terms of those that have smoked, I think it's roughly the same. I think it was at about 18%, about 17%. There was just recently a study that came out today that I'll provide the committee with or that I was brought, it was brought to my attention today, and will submit in written testimony. I haven't had an opportunity to fully review that, but we believe that you see many more people crossing state lines or going to purchase the tobacco through the internet, not so much that they're giving it up or quitting in terms of relation to the price. But I'll submit a copy of the study that we have for the committee's review, and would be happy to follow up on that with you.
Thank you. Please do, and I'd also be very interested in seeing that and comparing it to submitted testimony from the Heart Association as well.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. I had a question for you. So in one of the charts that I saw, it looks like the estimated tax cigarette cartons in Washington for 2016 actually goes above Oregon. Is that considering if we did implement an increased cigarette tax, or is that what the projections are?
Madam Vice Chair, that's exactly right. That 2016 is a hypothetical model of a $1 per pack tax increase. And the reason it does that is because the differential between the taxes has the most effect on the cross-border mm-hmm. purchases.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. And now I'd like to call up our Representative Alyssa Kinney-Geyer. Oops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alyssa Kinney-Geyer, representative for House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm also in a health committee at this time, so I'm sorry I didn't get to hear the other testimony, and I'm sorry if I repeat anything. I mostly wanted to be here to submit some documents for the record. I am a very, very strong and passionate supporter of a tobacco tax. I have a master's in public health. I serve on the Northwest Health Foundation. My career is really built around going upstream and making sure that we do prevention strategies so that we, as a state of Oregon, don't continue to see $1 billion go into health care costs for people who smoke and also have impacts from secondhand smoke. The estimates are also about $1 billion in lost productivity. So this is a very preventable costs in terms of the healthcare system and productivity. Places, I just heard a little bit of the previous testimony. The second page here with it, which is some documents that I asked for from the State Department of Oregon Health Authority, Public Health Department, mentions a price increase of 10% on cigarettes and other tobacco products will lead a 4% decrease in demand among adults and a 7% decrease in demand among youth. That is because youth are known to be more price sensitive. It is often said that you need a price increase of at least 50 cents a pack to see that kind of decrease, so it's really important. While we passed in the tobacco tax legislation a very modest increase on tobacco tax, that in itself brings in revenue but does not change behavior. It's really critical that we pass a significant tobacco tax in New York, for instance, which has the highest tobacco tax, and I am having my staff bring a sheet of all the different states tobacco tax. New York saw a significant decrease, particularly in New York City, which raised it even way above the $4 something that New York State has. When they implemented it, the rates of smoking went way down. So I worked very hard to look at what is the rate of taxation that would make sense for our state, given what happens in other states, what our tax is compared to neighboring states. The figure that I came up with was roughly $1.60 to $1.70. Thank you. Because $1.70 would have us roughly right at Washington State, so I know the metropolitan area might be worried with their retailers if we charge a lot more than Washington State. And $1.60 is what Minnesota passed in one fell swoop. There have been many states in the last few years that have raised their cigarette tax of $1 or more. Guam did it for $2. California has $2 on the ballot in November 2016. I was starting with a figure of $1.60 or going up to $1.70 is something that's reasonable that will both have a huge impact on cessation and prevention, particularly among those most price sensitive, and would bring in a significant amount of revenue. You may note that there's not really any big revenue on the table in this session, and yet in Health and Human Services, we're asked to, from the co-chair's budget, to cut $140 million in order to get some more money over to education. And so this is a very, very serious idea. I actually put a lot of time and thought into what is the amount that we should be charging. Another thing that I looked at was what is roughly the percentage of tax on other tobacco products like cigars and other things. It's hard for us to tell since we do not yet have a licensing in place. We don't know what the retail is, but we know wholesale. So the $1.60 would bring cigarette taxes roughly in alignment with the other tobacco tax. Again, you don't want to do something that causes unintended consequence. In addition to thinking really long and hard about what the amount of the tobacco tax revenue should be that would make sense, I had many, many conversations in the community with some of the people who I believe are testifying today about where that money should go. Again, it's really critical that if we want to get on top of this problem, that we use the revenue that we bring from this tax to really tackle the problem. So a good chunk of it, and I didn't lay out, you know, percentages, but a good chunk should obviously go to prevention through the state public health department and the county public health departments, their TPAP program, which is the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. We are way underfunding our program compared to what CDC recommends states spend. And in the governor's recommended budget, there's actually $4 million that was removed from that. So this is really, really critical. If we want to get on top of this problem, we need to be funding it, prevention strategies, and not going the other direction. We also, I believe, should be beefing up our school-based health centers, school nurse, and behavioral health programs for a variety of reasons. But again, if we want to get at kids, we know that smoking is related to mental health, addictions. There's all of these things. If kids are on top of understanding stresses in their lives, bullying, a whole variety of things, all of those things are linked to behaviors that lead to addictions such as smoking. So we need to really target youth where they are. And regional equity coalitions, we know that people in low-income communities and communities of color and people with mental health and addictions smoke at disproportionately higher rates. So again, targeting prevention in low-income communities and communities of color is really important. The other areas that I believe that our distribution should include are cessation. And one of those, again, specifically targeted to low-income communities and communities of color through partnerships with public health departments, CCOs, community-based groups, through a program that OHA already has, the SIM kind of grant partnerships they have with community groups. That's the state innovation model. And then lastly, partnerships with mental health and addiction services. The old thinking used to be, you know, we really can't get on top of tobacco smoking, cigarette smoking, until we take care of mental health, we take care of other addictions. And the head of, I believe it's called Bridgeway Resources, who is here in Salem, runs an addiction services, and he said, you know, it is an addiction. If we are ever serious about getting on top of addictions, tobacco and others, then we really need to put resources into that. And we can't just keep waiting to deal with that particular addiction at the end. So putting some money into the Oregon Health Authority Mental Health and Addiction Services to work with addiction, that's kind of the stepchild of mental health. We have report after report in the Willamette Week and other places that talk about how little we fund our addiction services. We need to turn this around. There's a lot of science, a lot of evidence-based programs out there that talk about the impact both of pricing on behavior and where revenue can best be used. So thank you so much. I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions?
I have a question.
Representative Whitsitt.
Yeah, thank you. And this is something I don't know, and I'd never really contemplated it until I was just listening to you. Do you have any statistics on the numbers of people who use cigarettes to cope with other addictions instead of taking drugs, illegal drugs, for example, or mental illness? Because a lot of people substitute cigarettes for those other things that they perceive are worse, or that society perceives as worth.
I don't have that particular statistics. I believe that it's 70% of people with mental health and addictions also smoke, and there hopefully is someone who's coming behind me who can address that. Of those who maybe didn't smoke before but have those conditions and then turn to smoking, I'm not sure about that. But certainly that is the case, you know. But unfortunately, using that as a coping mechanism, while you might think, well, at least they're not on heroin, yes, that's true. There's kind of the old adage, do no harm. So, okay, people used to think, okay, well, smoking's better than that. But we know the incredible impacts of smoking itself on our bodies. And so if we just kind of stop there and go, okay, at least they're not doing heroin or meth, they're doing smoking, we're discounting the enormous impact that has. But the other piece of it, and this is what, you know, I went to a public health conference just this fall and watched a video clip, which I'm also happy to send and put on the record, from the head of the Bridgeway Recovery Resources, something like that, is that if you think that you're going to help someone get over some of their behavioral issues with addictions by saying, okay, we'll just smoke instead, then you're not really getting at the root cause. So we have to, just like domestic violence and all the other conversations we have in here, we have to get at the cycle and really help people figure out what is it that is driving them to these behaviors that are really destructive for their health? But thank you for the question, Representative Whitson.
I just want to follow up. Like, the counties that I represent are some of the poorest in the state, and so we don't have, as a policy, mental health help down there. And so a lot of the people that I hear from, they're using cigarettes to help them cope because there isn't anything else, because there isn't any money. But I understood what you were saying about where we need to go with it. But that's sort of the input we're getting in the really poor counties, because there aren't psychiatrists and there aren't counselors available and there aren't programs. So they're using cigarettes to help.
I completely understand that. And I think some of the mistakes that we've made in the past, for instance, the ballot measure that was defeated a few years ago, it was targeted to the cigarette revenue. The cigarette tax revenue was targeted at the Children's Health Insurance Program. And while, you know, no one really wants to be against the Children's Health Insurance Program, people felt that, you know, why are you having cigarette smokers pay for that particular program? And so I think it's really critical that we think very seriously about where the revenue goes. And that is why I said county public health, which is really struggling, you know, particularly in your county and some others, county public health departments are devastated, and yet they're the ones that do a lot of these tobacco prevention programs. And so that infrastructure is critically important. And the schools, you know, you may know that we have a ratio of nurses in schools that I think is 1 to 750. We are among the worst in the country, and that is partly because the nursing and behavioral nurse program comes out of the state school fund. So as the state school fund has gone down, we've been laying, you know, we're worried about class ratio and class size, length of school year, and so we're cutting school nurses. And that's absolutely the opposite direction we should go. But we don't have a revenue source for that. Right now it comes out of the state school fund. This, at $1.60, would bring in $722 million every biennium, which is several hundred million over what we have now. This is a very serious attempt at dealing with a very serious issue that we give lip service to every year and never get on top of. So if there's any serious attempt to go forward, I would be honored to be a part of that, you know, work on amendments or whatever, but I wanted to at least get on the record some of the results of multiple conversations I've had with many community groups as well as our own public health departments. So thank you very much.
Representative Benz.
So here's the challenge. Any of us that have kids or any of us that know people who smoke, I think some folks in my law office have tried to quit uncountable times.
Right.
And simply, they just can't. I've looked at some of these cessation programs. It looks like they have about a 10% success rate. So I understand the value of raising the price to keep young people from smoking completely.
Right.
But I don't know how to justify the weight that then places upon all of those who would like to quit but can't. And I don't think we can take refuge in cessation programs that don't seem to work. So what is I have my word for what I just said, but what are my words for describing it. How do you describe it?
So thank you for that question, and I do think prevention is really key because it's way easier to not start smoking than it is to stop. Cigarette addiction is far more addictive than alcohol, marijuana, a whole bunch of things out there. It's someone who works in this field can tell you exactly what the addiction rate is, but it's phenomenally high in terms of, and so everything we can do, and some of the rural counties, and I hope there's someone behind me who knows about this, particularly if there was someone from the public health department here, but I don't see them here. There are some really innovative programs happening through CCOs, and I want to say Jackson County or somewhere in the south or on the coast, who's doing some very innovative programs in the schools to deal with bullying behavior, and it's part of a whole long-term prevention strategy on a number of different addictions, yes, cigarette and others. But the compliance, just to get to the other side of it.
I understand the part. What I'm getting to is, what do we describe? How do we go to those people, like those that work in my law firm,
right,
who can't quit?
Right.
And we say to them, all these goods are going to be achieved by virtue of raising the price, but too bad for you. We know you can't quit. You're just going to have to pay more, and that's just the cost of society. Too bad for you.
So
is that the way we explain this to them?
That's not what the data actually says. The data actually says that the more you raise the price, the more you actually do have people who are already smoking and smoking. The compliance rate is very different from different groups. For instance, the highest compliance rate with smoking cessation programs is pregnant women. They are highly motivated to quit. I believe it's somewhere around 80-85%. It's very sad if they start smoking again later, but boy, if we can reduce some of the birth outcomes from people quitting smoking during pregnancy, great. Some programs have higher rates than others. There's a whole variety of programs that have different cessation rates. In addition to just raising the price, it's critical that the revenue goes to programs that help those people, because what you presented to me was, okay, we're going to raise the price. Tough luck if you get. It's critical that's why I don't put it all toward prevention, that we actually put programs in place that are evidence-based that do show compliance. I would love to go further, if you can give me one more minute here. That place-based conference that I went to talked about a number of different strategies in addition to cessation programs that support these kinds of things. For instance, maybe giving retail, I didn't catch all of Plaid Pantries, but giving retail some incentives to do things like putting cigarettes under the counter, not having advertising out there where they get a lot of money right now. Those are the kinds of things when people try to quit, it's very hard for them to quit when they constantly have these reminders. Those kind of programs have shown to help. Those environmental factors have been shown to help compliance rates.
Follow up. My question has still not been answered, and I don't blame you for not wanting to answer it. It's a very difficult thing to say that we're going to impose this cost upon a whole bunch of people that can't quit, no matter how well-meaning the programs are that we designed to try to make them quit. There's a whole bunch of folks out there that will be bearing the cost of, I hate to say, poor choices, because perhaps they were tempted into this for any number of reasons. The point is, there's a whole bunch of people like that are going to bear this cost so that the price is higher for those we're trying to prevent from smoking. What do we say to them? What's the right thing to say? I don't want to go into prevention again. I want to know what should we say to that group? They can't quit. They're stuck paying the extra money. What do we say to them?
I would say, with all due respect, I'm not sure I buy the assumption that they can't quit. I do not buy that assumption. I think there, for some people, it is harder and harder, and we need to look at strategies. I'm on the board of Northwest Health Foundation. We did a study that we shared with the U.S. Congress several years ago that shows the more you raise the price, because there was a big concern about low-income people. What do you do about low-income people in particular who have a hard time quitting, and they're going to have to pay more and more of a very small salary? And the study showed that the more you raise the price, actually there's a net savings in the pocketbook, not only from the savings of not buying at the retail store, but also the health impacts. So for the people who have a really hard time quitting despite all these programs, it's a user fee. It is. I mean, this is something that we talk about here in the legislature, about when you do certain things, then you bear the cost for that. And, you know, I don't want to do it with blame and got you, you know. But, I mean, we want to do everything we can with the revenue to help people quit. At some point, people do bear the consequences of their behavior.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to take a whack at Representative Bent's question, or at least part of it. I used to practice psychology, and while I never was actively involved in the treatment of addictions after my training, I was in the beginning of my training as a psychologist. One of the things we're very aware of in addiction treatment is that addiction recovery rates in any one particular treatment process tends to be fairly low. I mean, the point you made, I think, is absolutely correct. What does happen with people who are motivated to quit is that they try different modalities, they try different approaches, they go to different treatment programs, they go back to the same program that now has a more scientifically based treatment process, or they try the old thing that they tried before that didn't work before, and that you find about the same rate of reductions of the acting on the addiction each time it happens. So your success rate for any one process may only be 10% or 15% or 20%. People who try over and over again tend eventually to be successful. And if a cigarette tax has the effect of providing that motivation for some people, then you're going to increase the likelihood of return to sobriety or ending of smoking or whatever it is that the addiction is that you're dealing with. And that's a finding that is repeated over and over and over again in dealing with pretty much all of the addictive substances in the treatment programs. The other thing I would note is that if we have the funds available for proper training in addiction treatment programs, which are severely stressed now all over the state, you're likely to use far more scientifically based, outcomes-based treatment processes, which also improve outcomes as you go along. There will, of course, be some people who will just pay the tax because they are the unlucky ones who are unable to get off the sauce or off of the tobacco.
Well, if I may just add one more thing on that, you know, that user fee, that tax that they're paying for not having stopping their smoking is basically a down payment on the health care costs that we then as a society end up paying, whether it's through the Oregon Health Program, whether it's through commercial insurance that all of us pay. You know, we do end up having to take care of those health care costs, and that is their contribution to that.
Follow up.
Madam Vice Chair, could I first? Because I have a response to Representative Bence as
okay,
well.
Okay, we'll let him do the follow-up.
Okay.
So it strikes me that if we did what you're suggesting, we would at least avoid some of the hypocrisy that goes with the current arrangement. By that I mean when we take the money from these folks who can't help themselves and use it for something other than trying to help them get out of this trap they've been caught in, at least we would enjoy that when we talk to ourselves at night about having raised the price on these folks that can't quit. But we haven't done that yet. I would also note that I haven't had, thank goodness, the chore of working as a psychologist with anyone who's addicted, but I've seen a lot of people who are, yeah. And whether it's gambling or whether it's cigarettes or whether it's alcohol or whether it's marijuana or whatever it's going to be, caffeine, the fact that our state determines that it's going to run its operations on these folks' backs is a little unsettling. And we saw that with our former colleague who did all she could to try to stop the gambling situation. So I'm not enthusiastic terrifically about your testimony when it comes to the well-meaning outcome that you hope for, because I don't think it's going to happen. I just have this strong belief that we will not see all the money, if this tax goes through, go to offsetting addictions. don't see it happening. But maybe it will.
Well, I would hope you guys would write the amendments strong enough, you know, that it does. Be happy to help in that regard.
Representative Smith Warner. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. To respond again in a more practical and less theoretical way than Chairman Barnhart did to Representative Bence's question, I have a lot of friends who are letter carriers, and there's a saying that letter carriers have. There's no such thing as a dog that doesn't bite, just a dog that hasn't bitten yet. And I would say that in quitting smoking in particular, that is the only addiction for which I can personally testify. I quit smoking for the first time in 1996 and did not do it for the last time until 2002. Because indeed, it is something a lot of times you have to do over and over until you are successful at. And so what I would say to those people is partially what Representative Kenny Geyer said about indeed it is a user fee, even though it is something that I completely agree is an addiction, and let it be that economic and behavioral motivation to try another time to quit and hope that it will be the last. And if that is the motivation, which I think it can significantly be, then so much the better. So that is what I would say to people. Let this have this be your next motivation to quit again, because every smoker I know every smoker I know has tried to quit or wants to quit. I know many ex-smokers as well. And if that is the motivation and that gets them to success, then so much the better.
Thank you. Representative Whitson.
This is just sort of a comment. Since we're having a discussion, I mean, this is sort of like a discussion. I think we can't forget, too, in this whole health thing of the general population, addiction to food. And I see that our general life expectancy has gone down the last couple of years because people are so overweight. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I know this really doesn't have to do with smoking, but it has to do with a general thing mm-hmm. on health. And, you know, it's just a statement, no question for you or anything. But I think when we're looking at, for the health of Oregonians, I think probably more people are affected by being overweight and that destroying their health than any other single thing. And just a statement.
Thank you, Representative Whitsitt. You probably would not be too surprised to know that I'm a strong supporter of a soda tax as well. I think that we have to be very serious about incentives to stopping behavior, but also revenue to support people making those choices. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I don't have anyone else signed up. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, great discussion today. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2555. And if there's nothing else, go ahead and close the meeting on the House Committee on Revenue for today.
Thank you. Nicely done. Thank you.